be Bevand, if I'm saying it right, versus One West Bank.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor.
How many?
3 minutes.
All right.
May it please the Court, Richard Llewellyn Jones appearing on behalf of Ms. Bevand. I would characterize this particular appeal as the appeal of two notes, or the tale of two notes.
Let me ask you some questions. As you probably know, we discussed cases this afternoon. I've got some questions.
Yes, sir.
First of all, this Court previously ruled that your two reply briefs were not properly before the Court and then gave you leave to file a consolidated reply brief, not to exceed 35 pages, and you didn't do that, right?
No, I believe that I responded by filing a new a brief.
So you have a reply brief before this Court subsequent to the judge's ruling that your two previous separate briefs were rejected?
That is my understanding, Your Honor, and the date of it is July 5th of 2016.
My next question is this. It's unclear from your opening brief who is the object of your claim that there was some violation of the Deeds of Trust Act. It's clear that you're attacking the actions or omissions of Northwest Trustee Services.
That is true. Yes.
What specifically are you attacking that either or both of the other two defendants did or did not do?
One West, Your Honor, and MERS?
Yes.
Well, first of all, the purported beneficiary of the two notes would have been either One West or some other entity. The difficulty with this is that One West was the agent that Northwest Trustee Service was purporting to foreclose on behalf of. Our position is that depending upon which note is being referred to in the foreclosure documents, or should I say which version of the note and which endorsement is being relied upon by One West and Northwest Trustee Services, we have issues, and they flow back and forth between the two of them. The position is that it appears that only one of the notes was in the possession of One West. They had, however, in their records another version endorsed by a separate individual.
Okay. So my understanding of what you just said, I want to just make sure we're on the same wavelength. Your client only executed one promissory note.
That is correct.
Not two notes.
That is correct.
Okay. Your claim is that there are in the record two copies of her note, right?
I would have to agree with that because we've never seen any original. No original has ever been produced. All we've got are copies.
Talk about originals other than the fact that it's undisputed that your client only signed one original note.
Correct.
Okay. In the record, there are copies of that note, one of which bears an endorsement in blank by one natural person on behalf of the initial lender.
Correct.
And then there's another copy of a promissory note, marked certified copy, that's endorsed by another natural individual in blank on behalf of the same corporation, right?
I don't know that to be true.
Well, I've looked at the record and I know it to be true. So if you have some other version, please tell me now.
Happy to do so. The stamp that was affixed to one of the copies is certified true and correct. It is located in a position that could easily be masked and reproduced and another endorsement put on it. Without seeing the original, there's about four or five different iterations that this could follow. And until we have the actual note before us, we don't know which note and which endorsement is the correct one.
Well, the copy that is in the record shows certified copy on the face page.
That is correct.
And then on the last page of the note, it shows the endorsement in blank.
That is true.
Okay, so I don't understand what you're trying to say about the certified copy stamp possibly masking an endorsement. There is no such indication in the record.
They may both have been certified copies.
Well,
because
do you have any evidence other than
speculation? Yes, I do. There was a declaration that was filed by a Ms. Butler who said that at the time of closing there was an original and three copies made.
Okay, well let me get back to my question. Who other than MERS and Northwest Trustee Services is the object of your claim that there was a violation of the Act? Are you saying that One West is
Your Honor, the deed of...
Yes or no?
No, because the Deed of Trust Act regulates...
So One West, under your argument, did not violate the terms of the Deed of Trust Act. Is that what you just said?
I would have to agree with that, because
so
it doesn't regulate.
Your argument is directed first to MERS and then to Northwest Trustee Services.
Well, the Deed of Trust Act is
yes
relevant...
Yes or no?
Yes and no. Northwest Trustee Services is the agency that would be regulated under the Deed of Trust Act, and any agent that they rely upon would necessarily fall under the rubric, but not directly.
Okay. With respect to your claim of violation of the Consumer Protection Act, I take it that you, at minimum, claim that there was a violation by MERS, right?
Yes. MERS assignment is what I cited.
Okay. And then... With respect to the bank, is there any claim that it violated the Consumer Protection Act? And if so, what?
Only insofar as it is relying upon a note that was never verified, passing it off as I would argue as a counterfeit. That's the argument that's being made.
That's the first time I've heard counterfeit in any of the briefing.
I believe that is the claim. When you take a negotiable instrument and you alter it, and pass it off, that's counterfeiting the obligation.
Are you referring to your theme of the two notes, the two copies? Are we on that subject?
Well, ultimately, yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Okay, so it's your, and do you have any evidence in the record to suggest that there was any counterfeiting of the original promissory note?
Yes, the two separate endorsements. Why would an agency like One West have two separate endorsements? Why would anybody, and this is an issue of fact, why would anybody endorse a copy of a promissory note?
Okay, so with respect to Northwest Trustee Services, you're claiming that they violated the Consumer Protection Act, right? Answer the question.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Ryan Carson for the respondent. Since there's two of us, we're going to do it 6 minutes, 4 minutes.
Which are you?
I'm the 6 minute.
Go ahead.
And
you're representing?
I represent MERS and One West Bank.
All right.
Excuse me. This two-note argument is a red herring. The Ninth Circuit has already ruled that One West Bank held the note, was the beneficiary of record at the time that all the foreclosure activity took place, and respondent's position is that's the law of the case. The only remand back to state court was to suss out some of these issues under the CPA. Ms. Bavon wants to relitigate all of these issues over and over again, and this is indeed the fourth court to have looked at these issues. But frankly,
if I understand the remaining CPA claim, insofar as that is concerned, the argument is that the plaintiff received at some point a copy, both of these copies, or that revealed two different endorsements, were somehow communicated to the plaintiff, which was deceptive or confusing in some way. That seems to be the argument. Is that right? That's the basis for at least one Consumer Protection Act claim. But this is not a widespread practice, as I understand it. This is not something that occurs on a regular basis, or does it?
Your Honor, I would say that that's One West's position, which is that if a mistake was made, i.e. that, as he said, the declaration of Ms. Butler, that when the note is first executed, copies are made, the escrow company stamps is certified, the copies, these get put into circulation. If Ms. Bavan saw the two versions, or saw the version that was a stamped copy, and that was a mistake. That is a mistake sort of unusual and limited to the facts that you see before you with this particular case. It is not a widespread practice. Obviously,
it's not like a MERS assignment.
Correct.
Which happens a lot.
That's fair. Yes, Your Honor. The respondents have argued that not only is it not a widespread public interest problem, it's also not a per se violation, and also she's got a causation problem. Right? The proximate cause to all of this that's happened to Ms. Bavand here is the loan default. Ms. Bavand said in her deposition that these are rental properties that are owned by her, but are managed by her husband. She doesn't testify that. She testifies that not until 2011 was she even aware that some of this Freddie Mac issue might have been a problem. But
not
the loan default.
What you just said, and going back to something we said in the prior case, it's well established in Washington that the security follows the note in this case, right?
Precisely right, Your Honor.
And that means that here, the deed of trust would follow the promissory note.
Precisely right.
And so, in a sense, since that is by operation of law, the assignment by MERS is really irrelevant, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
This is on consideration and appeal of a summary judgment motion. We have three declarations, one by One West, one by Ocwen, which was the loan servicer who took over later, and one by MERS that established fairly clearly the chain of the possession of the documents, who had possession of the note at what time, what the actual note says, what the endorsements contain, and there just simply isn't a question of fact. Once you take those declarations into account as to who the proper parties were, as to the foreclosure, and who had the authority to act, who had the authority to appoint the trustee, and who had authority to push the foreclosure to its end.
Okay, well, the plaintiff's theme in this case seems to be the two notes. That's what was told to us in oral argument. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how it happened. Now, I understand that you say that it wasn't deceptive, it wasn't public interest, and it didn't cause any injury. But just to satisfy my curiosity, what exactly happened and why did it happen? And do you wish it hadn't happened, or was it a mistake, or does it, just what's the deal here with the two?
Indeed, it most likely was a mistake. And, of course, if I had been able to advise my client way, way back in time, I would say that, make doubly sure that you're not printing and stamping imaged copies, right? All of this stuff is electronic. So once the original note is executed, it's being placed into a secure vault. Images of that particular note are placed into the computer systems of the given...
Endorsed in blank by somebody.
Correct, Your Honor. That would have been imaged after it had been endorsed in blank. But it's also possible that the certified true copy stamped version, right? That was stamped most likely by the escrow company at closing. So you have the executed note, then you have certified true copy, certified true copy, certified true copy.
And why does it have a different name on it? Whose name is that? I mean,
it's a different officer of the same company, is it not?
That is my recollection, Your Honor, as well.
And the reply that you just gave is really not reflected in the record. It's your understanding of what likely happened. Isn't that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. I don't have the particular information as to how these documents got imaged. But if the question is how it might have happened, this is my informed, I guess, opinion. But it is somewhat speculation. What we, what's before the court here is... The declarations of the officers of these companies, and it's uncontested, aside for speculation that there was some wrongdoing at some point. And I just don't think the weight of the evidence, given the presence of any alternative speculative evidence, is enough to overcome what was before the trial court.
I forgot that you were going to have.
Yes, I was just about to pass.
All right,
co-counsel.
May it please the court, once more, Joshua Scherer for Northwest Trustee. Your Honors, first of all, again, we have an unambiguous beneficiary declaration for the trustee in this case. Now,
time is short. Let me ask you a question. You are asking this court to say, largely based on what the federal courts have said, that Levan has no standing to make certain challenges in this case. Is that correct?
There is persuasive case law that a borrower should not be able to challenge the appointment of successor trustee when they assented in the deed of trust to that process occurring.
What is the state law on standing? Because you apparently are relying on federal cases.
You know, that's because no state appellate court, to my knowledge, has directly addressed that issue at this time.
Well, here we are.
And here we are.
There are two elements under state law for standing. There has to be injury traceable to the challenge conduct. Number two, the person who is making the assertion must be within the zone of interest protected by the relevant statute. Given those two criteria, why, if at all, do you believe the ban has no standing here?
Well, starting with injury, Your Honor, there's no injury from the appointment of successor trustee because, as I mentioned, that right is vested in the deed of trust for the lender to appoint the trustee. And that's exactly what occurred in this case. And so Ms. Bavand is not injured by the fact that the lender is exercising its contractual rights. Now, they may have challenges to the procedure after that appointment accrues, but that's a separate issue as to whether there's injury, in fact, from the appointment itself.
Why can't you argue that just as effectively under state law? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to communicate is a certain sense of resistance to just dragging in federal law or other state laws into Washington State's analysis. We have our own statute. We have our own jurisprudence. It seems to have worked effectively up to this point. Why would we start over and start litigating standing under federal law?
It's just a matter of the fact that the Western District primarily has analyzed that specific issue in the context of an appointment of successor trustee.
Under their own law. Why do we want to be like the Western District? Isn't it more like the Western District wants to be like us?
They're analyzing it in terms of the Deed of Trust Act, which is state law.
Yeah. There's at least one reported case where there was implicitly a determination by an appellate court of the state that standing existed in challenging the appointment of a successor trustee. Do you know the case I'm talking about?
I think it's been implied in a number of cases, Your Honor. But
well, more than implied.
I don't think it's been explicitly addressed by any state court, and it would – the federal courts that have addressed this issue under the Washington Deed of Trust Act have said otherwise. I see that
I'm
out of time.
Looks like you've used your time.
Apparently I have. We'd ask you to affirm. Thank you, Your Honors.
So, Mr. Jones, you want to pick up on that last question?
Happy to do so, Your Honor. If there are two notes, to which note does the deed of trust attach? If there is a note...
I'm talking about notes. I'm talking about standing.
I'm getting there. If, in fact, there is a problem with the appointment of successor trustee because the successor trustee is trying to enforce the wrong note to which the deed of trust is attached, what authority do they have to foreclose? If they attempt to foreclose without establishing their authority based upon which note we're talking about, then my client has been prejudiced because her home is being taken. They claim that there has to be prejudice and technical difficulties don't apply. Sadly, that line of cases relates to post-sale cases, not pre-sale cases such as this one. So there is no prejudice element to a CPA claim. And as far as the standing is concerned, I think the court has articulated what I understand to be the case as well in this state under state law, that my client has standing to object to the conduct of the trustee.
Doesn't mean you're going to win, though.
Thank you for the forewarning, Your Honor. I'm glad my client is not in the courtroom. But having said that... I'd like to address the issue of Judge Robart's decision. Judge Robart remanded this case back on the CPA claim for good reason, and he stated there were issues of fact. Now, of course, the state court could say, well, we've now analyzed on a summary judgment, and we don't find any issues of fact. But the existence of those two notes is critical. Which note are we talking about? And to the issue of the standing, Your Honor.
Critical, apparently, to your CPA claim, because that's the only thing that was remanded.
That is true, but the CPA claim is fairly embracive. You know, when you look at the Bain decision, if there's a problem with the process, the client, and we look at Frias, there's no claim under the Deed of Trust Act for my client. It's only in the context of a CPA claim.
So precisely, how did this work? In other words, when was your client deceived? And about what?
My client was deceived by the attempt of One West to foreclose a note which may not be a true and correct note, that they had been given somehow or other a counterfeit note.
Aren't these two copies of the same original note?
Well, yes. Unfortunately.
And isn't this the obligation your client acknowledges she signed?
That's true. But that doesn't mean that One West has either one of them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.